So we are in 1 Samuel. Last week we finished chapter 24. I was listening to Ron Dart, who's the only Bible guy on the radio that I listened to, and he was actually in Matthew, but he talked tangentially about the incident where David cuts off part of Saul's garment. And he had a very interesting take on it. I have no idea if it's true. He didn't present it as true. I'm not suggesting that he said this is gospel. But he was talking in terms of tzitzit, the blue tassel that Hebrews are commanded to wear on the corners of their garment. And his comment was that that was to identify you as a commandment keeper, which is correct. I agree with that. And then he said, one of the things that people do, which makes great sense because people do it, is wear indicators of rank on their clothing. The obvious example from our society is the military, where you wear special clothing and you've got special patches and badges sewn on your clothing to identify your rank. So what he was speculating is that perhaps Saul, as the king, had something like special stripes on his robe or something like that to set him apart as the king. That's what David cut off, his indicator of position and status. What Dart then said is, David had been anointed king by Samuel. David knew that he was going to replace Saul. So when he went in and cut a piece off of Saul's robe, what he was doing was cutting off the symbol of kingship because it no longer belonged to Saul, but belonged to him now. And when he did that, he immediately regretted it. And we have then the ensuing scene where he tells Saul that he's sorry and he's no threat to him and so forth. But I thought that was really an interesting take on the incident in the cave where he sneaks up and clips a piece off of Saul's robe, that what might have been happening there is he was cutting off the symbol of royalty because it was no longer rightfully Saul's. So anyway, that's an interesting little tidbit. Don't have any idea if it's true, but I like it. I will add that now to my repertoire from now on because I think it was that good. What happened last time is Saul went full paranoid, probably bipolar. Don't know that, but certainly paranoid. And, for example, kills all the priests at Nob, accusing them of conspiring with David against him. And, of course, the priest has a perfectly reasonable explanation. David's your number two man. Totally within his right and my expectation that he should come and ask me for help. I didn't see anything wrong at all. And, of course, Saul has them all killed. The other thing is, of course, when David cuts off the corner of his robe and then he apologizes from across the valley, doesn't get too close to apologize, but apologizes from a distance, Saul is contrite. He says, you are more righteous than I, and surely now God will establish your kingdom, and please make sure that you deal with my family well when that happens. So the next thing, of course, that's going to happen is Saul is going to get home and he's going to go back the other way and he's going to try and kill David again. So he's not only completely paranoid, he may in fact be bipolar, manic depressive, where his personality swings back and forth in addition to, as I say, to the paranoia. What David does, by the way, at the end of the incident is basically leaves the area. He goes to the Philistines to get out of Saul's reach because he doesn't put any faith whatsoever in Saul's change of heart after the incident of the cave, and properly so. So tonight we'll start on chapter 25. Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in his house at Ramah. One of the things we read earlier in the book is Samuel never really ceased to mourn for Saul. Samuel obviously liked Saul and was kind of brokenhearted. when Saul didn't measure up, and he had to then tell Saul that his reign was over and David was going to be the next king. In fact, you might say, again, this is speculation, that he sort of went back home and said, all right, I'm done. He certainly didn't judge anymore because we now had a king. So the function of a judge had been taken over by the king, and you sort of get the impression that Samuel went home and dropped out of public sight and just spent the rest of his life quietly and also mourning what happened to Saul. So verse 1.5. Then David rose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. And there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife Abigail. As we'll see in just a minute, Nabal means fool. And I can't imagine any parent naming their little boy fool. But that was his name. And Abigail means father's joy. So the woman was discerning and beautiful. In other words, she was not only good looking, but she was smart. But the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite, so he was a descendant of Caleb. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus you shall greet him. Peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shearers. David is a man after God's own heart. David is God's anointed king. David wrote all the Psalms. He's a great man. But all I can think of is some mobster walking into a candy store. Nice little place you have here. I hear that you're shearing sheep. It feels very much like that kind of a conversation. I always get a kick out of this because, as I say, David was the anointed king and David was a man after God's own heart. So verse 7 again. I hear that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us and we did them no harm and they missed nothing all the time they were in Carmel. So it feels very much like a protection racket. Now, in David's defense, what's going to be said later by Nabal's herdsmen is that David, in fact, actively did protect them when they were down in his area. They kept animals run off, and he was, in fact, not just a local mafioso, but he was, in fact, actively watching over their stuff. So you sort of need to temper this by that understanding. Verse 8, ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give up whatever you have at hand to your servant and to your son David. So harvest time, sheep shearing. This is the time when all the hard work is going to pay off. We see the same thing in the book of Ruth, where Ruth goes to Boaz as they're harvesting, and this is the time of the year when all the hard work pays off. And so David shows up and says, I'd like a share of this celebration. Verse 9, when David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and then they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants, who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? All right, now, who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? He knows who David is. This is not a query of who is this guy. This is a query of what is his status and why should I care what he wants? The fact that he knows that he's the son of Jesse indicates that he knows who David is. So who is David and who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Should I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men who come from I do not know where? The idea, of course, is David has fled from his master, Saul, and David is basically abandoned. So as far as Nabal is concerned, this guy David has no status that he needs to respect, and certainly no claim on any of the feasts that he has set up. Verse 12, So David's young men turned away and came back and told him all this. And David said to his men, "Every man strap on his sword." And every man of them strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword. And about 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage. One of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, "Behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master, and he railed at them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm, and we did not miss anything when we were in the fields, as long as we went with them." The idea is they deliberately stayed near to David because David and his men would protect them. So it's not just the fact that David happened to be the local warlord in that area and kept order and so forth. It was, in fact, they sort of looked like they actively tried to stay near him for his protection. 16. "They were a wall to us, both by night and by day, all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Now therefore, know this and consider what you should do. For harm is determined against our master and against all his house. And he is such a worthless man that one cannot speak to him." The "he" here is Nabal. By the way, the word that is translated as worthless is "sons of Belial." And apparently that was a Hebrew idiom for, I would gently say, probably "son of a bitch." "Son of Belial" was that kind of a epithet. So they've gone to Abigail, who has got some sense, and they have said, "We are in big trouble. David was good to us. He shielded us, he protected us, and our master is such a worthless fellow that nobody can tell him this." So what they're doing is telling Abigail instead, and of course Abigail is going to take action. Verse 18. "Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves and 2 skins of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 seahs of parched grain and 100 clusters of raisin and 200 cakes of figs and laid them on donkeys. And she said to her young men, 'Go on before me, I come after you.' But she did not tell her husband Nabal, because again, he would have told her not to. And as she rode on the donkeys and came down under cover of the mountain, behold, David and his men came down toward her, and she met them. Now David had said, 'Surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David and more also, if by morning I have so much as 1 male of all who belong to him.'" So David is annoyed. Abigail's speech is going to be really interesting. She's a very bright lady. "When Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, 'On me alone, my lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my lord regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my lord whom you sent. Now then, my lord, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving with your own hand, and let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my lord be as Nabal." Now notice what she says here. She is saying, "You're right to be angry. I didn't know anything about it, but I don't blame you for your anger. My husband is a worthless fool. However, don't take vengeance yourself and don't incur blood guilt on yourself." So what she is saying is, in your anger, understand that what you are about to do is way out of proportion to what has been done to you. Again, this is a bright lady. She's not at all dumb. And so what she does is she pitches it in terms of, you're about to commit murder over an insult. And you're about to kill innocent people over an insult. Don't do that. 27. And now let this present that your servant has brought to my lord be given to the young men who follow my lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant, for the Lord will certainly make my lord a sure house, because my lord is fighting the battles of the Lord. And evil shall not be found in you so long as you live. So this idea here is, you're going to be a great man. Please forgive us. And oh, by the way, we have, if you will, an offering as we ask for your forgiveness. But understand that what your instinct tells you you want to do, or your anger tells you you want to do, is out of proportion. 29. If men rise up to pursue you and seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living in the care of the Lord, your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause for grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause, or for my Lord taking vengeance himself when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, and then remember your servant. The idea, obviously, here is that what you are planning to do is out of proportion. It will have ramifications for a long time if you do something like that. You are destined for greatness, and you do not want to become king having done something like this. And she then brings a peace offering with her, which is the stuff that the young men would have gotten had Nabal not been a fool. So 32. And David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you, who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from avenging myself with my own hand. For surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me truly by morning, there had not been left to Nabal so much as one male." Then David received from her hand what she had brought him, and he said to her, "Go up in peace to your house. See, I have obeyed your voice, and I have granted your petition." She's obviously a very bright lady. She's also very decorative. And we'll see in a minute that she is going to wind up being one of his wives. 36. And Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she told him nothing of it all until the morning. In the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, and he became like a stone, which is to say, he became white as a sheet. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. I imagine probably what he had is the shock of it gave him a heart attack. 39. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord, who has avenged the insult I received at the hand of Nabal, and has kept back his servant from wrongdoing. The Lord has returned the evil of Nabal on his own head." Then David sent and spoke to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they said to her, "David has sent us to you to take you to him as his wife." And she rose and bowed with her face to the ground and said, "Behold, your handmaid is a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." Notice what she has said. "I will wash the feet of David's servants." One would expect, as David's wife, that isn't something that she would normally do. So this is a woman who knows how to turn a phrase, and she is very wise. 42. And Abigail hurried and rose and mounted a donkey, and her five young women attended her. She followed the messenger of David and became his wife. David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and both of them became his wives. Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was of Galim. We will see Michal again, of course, once David becomes king. Chapter 26. Then the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, "Is not David hiding himself on the hill of Hakaliah, which is on the east of Dashamon. So Saul rose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph with 3,000 chosen men of Israel to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul encamped on the hill of Hilkiah, which was beside the road on the east of Jeshimon. But David remained in the wilderness. Remember I said David has gotten out of town. He knows that if Saul keeps trying to chase him down, he's eventually going to catch him. But David remained in the wilderness. When he saw that Saul had come after him into the wilderness, David sent out spies and learned that Saul had come. Then David rose and came to the place where Saul had encamped, and David saw the place where Saul lay. With Abner the son of Ner, the commander of his army, Saul was laying within the encampment while the army was encamped around him. And what we are going to see is a egregious lack of operational security on Saul's part. Then David said to Ahimelech the Hittite, and to Joab's brother Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, "Who will go down with me to the camp to Saul?" And Abishai said, "I will go down with you." So David and Abishai went to the camp by night, and there lay Saul sleeping with the encampment, with his spear stuck in the ground at his head, and Abner and the army lay around him. Then Abishai said to David, "God has given your enemy into your hand this day. Now please let me pin him to the earth with one stroke of the spear, and I will not strike him twice. I'll kill him with one blow. This isn't going to be a long process. One blow is going to do it." But David said to Abishai, "Do not destroy him, for who can put his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" And David said, "As the Lord lives, the Lord will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he will go down into the battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should put my hand against the Lord's anointed, but take now the spear that at his head and the jar of water and let us go." So we're sort of having a repeat here of the cave incident. I'm going to make it very clear that David was in a position to kill Saul and refrain from doing so. The comment was that Saul's spear has shown up a number of times. He has winged it at David a couple of times. I think he even winged it at his son, didn't he? So it is maybe the case that, again, Saul's spear is a special mark of rank. There's an old English phrase, "That woman is plain as a pikestaff," which is to say she is not good looking, because a pikestaff is totally utilitarian, has no decoration on it whatsoever. But the spear of a king very well might be decorated. Verse 12. So David took the spear and the jar of water from Saul's head, and they went away. No man saw it or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep, because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen upon them. Verse 13. When David went over to the other side and stood far off on the top of the hill. So when he starts trash talking to Saul, he makes sure that he's got a decent distance between him and Saul. So he went over to the other side and stood far off on the top of the hill with a great space between them. And David called to the army and to Abner, the son of Ner, saying, "Will you not answer, Abner?" And Abner answered, "Who are you who calls to the king?" And David said to Abner, "Are you not a man? Who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not kept watch over your lord the king? For one of the people came in to destroy the king your lord. This thing that you have done is not good." So he's tweaking the commander of Saul's army, saying, "If you had been doing your job, I wouldn't have been able to do this." So he's sort of pretty much annoying everybody here. He's also, by the way, speaking the truth. It was Abner's job to set camp security, which he apparently failed to do. 16 again. "This thing that you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, you deserve to die, because you have not kept watch over your Lord, the Lord's anointed. And now, see where the king's spear is and the jar of water that was at his head." So Saul recognized David's voice and said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And David said, "It is my voice, my lord, O king." And he said, "Why does my lord pursue after his servant? For what have I done? What evil is on my hands? Now therefore, let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If it is the Lord who has stirred you up against me, may he accept an offering. But if it is men, may they be cursed before the Lord. For they have driven me out this day, that I should have no share in the heritage of the Lord, saying, go serve other gods. Now, what he's saying here is, if God has told you that I'm a problem, then so be it. But if somebody has been whispering in your ear that David is a traitor, then curse him, because I've been driven out for no reasons. 20. Now therefore, let not my blood fall to the earth away from the presence of the Lord. For the king of Israel has come out to seek a single flea, like one who hunts a partridge in the mountain. You've come out here with an elephant gun, and you're shooting at a flea, because Saul has got a good, probably heavy battalion or brigade with him. Lots of guys. Also, he's saying, I don't want to be killed out in the wilderness. When I die, I want to be in the Lord's presence. 21. Then Saul said, I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do you harm, because my life was precious in your eyes. Behold, I have acted foolishly and have made a great mistake. And David answered him and said, here is your spear, O king. Let one of the men come over and take it. Saul is saying, return, my son David, which is to say, come on back, all's forgiven. I won't bother you anymore. David says, send one of your guys over here to get the spear. I'm not coming with you. Again, David recognizes that Saul is probably bipolar, certainly insanely paranoid, and David is not foolish. 23. The Lord rewards every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. For the Lord give you into my hand today, and I would not put my hand against the Lord's anointed. Behold, your life was precious this day in my sight. So may my life be precious in the sight of the Lord, and may he deliver me from all tribulation. Notice what he said here. Your life was precious in my sight. Therefore, let my life be precious in the sight of the Lord. He does not say, let my life be precious in your sight, because Saul is not in a mental state where he would keep to any oath. And so David is asked for the protection of the Lord, but doesn't bother to ask for the protection of Saul. Then Saul said to David, blessed be you, my son David. You will do many things and will succeed in them. So David went his way, and Saul returned to his place. Chapter 27. Then David said in his heart, now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul. Very clear that he doesn't trust in Saul's change of mood, which has happened twice now. There is nothing better for me than that I should escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will despair of seeking me any longer within the borders of Israel, and I shall escape out of his hands. So David arose and went over, he and 600 men who were with him, to Achish the son of Maok, king of Gath. And David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail of Carmel, Nabal's widow. And it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, he no longer sought it. In other words, Saul was not willing to mount a raid against the Philistines in order to get rid of David. And by the way, notice that you've got, 600 men, but you've also got a large train of families. And that's going to come into play later on. Probably not tonight. We won't get that far. Verse 5. Then David said to Achish, if I have found favor in your eyes, let a place be given me in one of the country towns, that I may dwell there. For why should your servant dwell in the royal city with you? So that day Achish gave him Ziklag. Therefore Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. And the number of the days that David lived in the country of the Philistines was 1 year and 4 months. Now, what David is doing here is securing his freedom of action. What David is going to do is he is going to start doing raids against towns and destroying them and looting them. And he really doesn't want to do that living with the king of Gath. He wants to be someplace where his comings and goings are not noticed by everyone in the king's court. The comment was that this in many ways is different from when Jacob flees from his brother. And he goes up to his uncle in Haran, and he winds up becoming a de facto slave. He's not free to leave. So when he finally wants to leave with his four wives and 12 sons, Laban chases after him to try and bring him back. And it's only the intervention of God that changes that. David is not staying there long enough to have Achish do the same thing to him. One. However, David has got 600 men with him. So it's not the case that David is helpless. It isn't quite the same, but it's a good point. Verse 8. Now David and his men went up and made raids against the Geshurites, the Girzites, and the Amalekites. For these were the inhabitants of the land of old, as far as Shur to the land of Egypt. So he's raiding to the south of Gath, and he's raiding pagan cities. And David would strike the land and would leave neither man nor woman alive, but would take away the sheep, the oxen, the donkeys, the camels, and the garments, and come back to Achish. When Achish asked, "Where have you made a raid today?" David would say, "Against the Negev of Judah, or against the Negev of the Jerahmeelites, or against the Negev of the Kenites." In other words, what he's saying is, "I am raiding Israelites," when in fact what he's doing is raiding pagans. And I suspect that one of the reasons he wanted to live separate from Achish is so when he did that, he wouldn't be observed. And notice also when he comes back from these raids, he shares the booty with Achish. So he maintains good relationship with him, but he's also not being quite honest. The other thing that's kind of interesting is if you were a Girgashite or a Amalekite or whatever, you would regard David as a bandit. If you were the government of any of these towns, David would be a bandit. And it's interesting that Achish at Gath doesn't have any problem with him being a bandit. David comes back and splits the spoil with him, and there's no, "Wait a minute, I'm harboring a bandit here." That's kind of an interesting cultural observation in and of itself. And of course, the Philistines think he's raiding the Israelites, so no problem. Verse 11. And David would leave neither man nor woman alive to bring news to Gath, thinking, "Lest they should tell about us and say, 'So David has done.'" Such was his custom all the while he lived in the country of the Philistines. And Achish trusted David, thinking, "He has made himself an utter stench to his people Israel, and therefore he will always be my servant." He's not only crafty, but he's vicious. Because going into a small town and making sure there's nobody alive to rat you out is tough stuff. The comment was, "It's not that big a place. How can all this be going on without word getting out?" One, of course, he left nobody who could talk. But B, I suspect that Achish of Gath was just as happy to have the loot. We had in the army a phrase. There's a difference between knowing something and officially knowing something. If you officially know something, you are duty-bound to take action. If you simply know of something but you don't officially know it, nobody can pin the fact that you knew about it on you, then you can ignore it if you want to. So I'll give you examples. One of the things that happened when I was at West Point is cadets during football season would sneak out in the middle of the night and do pranks. They'd do things like steal cannons and move them around and, you know, just stuff. I am sure every officer on the post knew that this stuff was going on. But they didn't officially know that it was, in other words, nobody came to them and said, all right, Company E1 is going to swipe a cannon tonight and is going to put it in the superintendent's lawn. If somebody had said that to an officer, he would have had to take action. He'd have to do something. But if it was just, yeah, okay, we know what's going to happen tonight, and nobody actually officially knows, you can turn your head the other way if you want to. And so what I'm suggesting to you here is Akish was quite happy to turn his head the other way. He had a plausible story. I've been raiding southern Judah. Your enemies, O king. Look at all the stuff he's bringing back. So I suspect that if he unofficially knew what was going on, but didn't officially know, then he was probably quite happy just to sort of let things ride, because he was making a lot of money in the process. And these weren't his people. They were somebody else's people. So I'm sort of guessing that's what was going on, because your observation that it's a small place, and sacking and looting a town in an area that small, how could nobody know? And the other observation pertinent to what you just said is when David went up to Nob and got the showbread and Goliath's sword, he was observed by Doeg the Edomite, who just happened to be there. And the little bird went back and told Saul what had happened. And I certainly don't know, but I would speculate that there was probably some willful blindness on the part of Akish. So we'll quit here.